Bond. James Bond.
That's as bad as listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
I think you can kiss your trade franchise goodbye.
And hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye and our series on the films surrounding the James Bond franchise. This week we are taking on the, spoof slash Bond adjacent. I don't know how we'd characterize these, Mark. Is that right?
I think this was a serious attempt that went woefully wrong. I think they tried to do this as a serious American response to Bond, but it backfired on them because they weren't smart enough to know that their script was crap.
Yeah. So we're talking about the films Our Man Flint and In Like Flint, starring James Coburn and Lee J. Cobb, about American spy Derek Flint and misogyny.
Lots and lots of misogyny.
I am Andy Wilson, TV film critic at Graphic Policy and Bleeding Cool, and with me in our lonely isolation bunkers just got Mark.
Hello everybody, hi from San Antonio. We're still surviving. That's a good thing.
It's just the Texas crew holding us down here from the axis of Austin and San Antonio, because other people, I don't know, have stuff to do on Easter Sunday besides record a podcast about terrible movies. And we're like, no, that sounds good. That's good use of a couple of hours.
Screw the buddy. We'll talk movies.
Yeah. So, hey, Mark, you were originally one of the people who said, like, well, we should talk about this. And you mentioned it's kind of an American response to Bond. But, you know, what drew you to this? Or do you have any sort of, like, family or, like, personal history with these movies?
Nobody knew about these movies, and neither did I until I saw Austin Powers. And in one of his movies, which one was it? I forget which Austin Powers movie it was. I think it's the first one where he's watching TV and this movie comes up and he says, oh, this is my favorite movie, baby. And I'm like, what the hell is that? Is that James Coburn? So I looked it up and I found out that he made a movie as an American spy. And I'm like, oh, this is probably good. It's James Coburn. And no, it isn't. Yeah, I remember at that point I rented the movie. I forgot where from. Like, this is years and years ago. This is like 20 some years ago. And I rented the movie and I was like, what the hell is this? And it forever stayed in my memory. So I saw Our Man Flint first, and then later on, out of curiosity, I saw In Like Flint, hoping like maybe they improved on it, and it's so much worse the second time around.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
They did not. Yeah, I think that's an interesting bit. And I said this about Casino Royale, that I feel like the sort of lasting cultural legacy of that is that it helped inspire Austin Powers. And I feel like that is sort of the impact of these as well, even though there's other stuff here going on that we'll get into. But the Austin Powers linkage is very strong. The ringtone, anytime anyone calls on a phone in this movie, that's the same ringtone they use for, Austin Powers' phone. He loves it like Flint. And Mike Myers said that, he wanted to make Austin Powers because he and his dad used to watch these movies. And yeah, they'd watch James Bond, but they specifically liked Derek Flint. And I'm like, that's weird.
Like, why?
I'm like, who was that guy? I mean, Mike Myers' dad, I guess, who liked this. And I just watched.
I kind of get it, though. Because this is basically a 13-year-old boy's wet dream. You're super smart. You're smarter than everybody. You know everything. You got hot chicks around you. There's gadgets galore that are super ridiculous and don't seem to really have any real function. It's this pretend world that a 13-year-old would have created for himself. Like, this is something I would have created in my mind, running around my trailer at the age of 12, pretending, you know, living in a makeup world. This is something that maybe I would have sprung from my mind. So I totally get the appeal of a young Mike Myers, because he grew up, what, in the late 60s, early 70s?
Yeah.
So yeah. I understand the appeal from a child's perspective, but I saw these movies when I was, how old was I? Early 20s? So, like, seeing it was like, what the heck, dude? Like, this is just so stupid. And I kept watching it because it was so stupid that it was good stupid. If that explains itself. But it's just really not good. But if you look at it from a young boy's perspective during that time, I can see how they might have been into it.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. The other way to think about it is that with the explosion of James Bond onto the scene, the huge success of From Russia with Love and Goldfinger and Thunderball, a lot of movie studios put money into making spy movies. I mean, the same way that Star Wars inspired a lot of space movies and science fiction, a lot of them bad, so too did James Bond inspire a lot of spy movies. And I mean, I think we're living in that now with superhero movies and comic book movies. And, you know, a lot of, you know, nothing in Hollywood will, nothing creates success like success. So if they see something that's working, it's like, oh, if there's a Western that comes out that makes $2 billion, then guess what? We're going to get a bunch of Westerns.
Right.
That's just going to be the way that it is.
There's a tangent to that because when True Grit came, the remake to True Grit with Jeff Bridges came out, it was super awesome and fantastic. We had a new Magnificent Seven, which James Coburn was in. That was the total turd fest.
Yeah.
And clearly riding the coattails of the previous Western that just hit it big.
But it had Chris Pratt in it. Come on.
he was great. He couldn't save it. Sorry.
I like to call that movie the Mediocre Seven. It's like, I wouldn't call it a turd fest. I was okay with the movie, but it's like, how many different versions of that story are there, Mark? Like, in movies? And that is easily, like, the least good of all of them that I can think of.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of okay. It's just like, I don't know.
I mean, I have a problem with anachronism, and that movie had some of it. And I'm like, I can't get past that, man. It's just, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't Wild Wild West levels of a turd, but it...
No.
Not at all. But it just didn't do it for me. I found it real disappointing.
Right. Yeah, I agree. That was just not great. That not so Magnificent Seven. But I don't know. Yeah, good point. And I mean, I think that we should also point out that there have been other great Westerns that have come out, you know, after True Grit. I think that, I mean, I'm assuming it helped us get Hell or High Water made.
Oh, that was really good.
I think that is like one of the best movies of the last decade. I just
really good.
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah. I actually really like, it's kind of gory for a Western, but Bone Tomahawk. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That was surprisingly good and like really like disturbing for a Western. Like, I can't believe they went there, but they went there and it was pretty damn good.
Also gory, also good. The Proposition.
Proposition's great.
That's another good one.
Great. What did you think about Three Ten to Yuma?
Oh yeah. I really liked 310 to Yuma. I have to admit though, I've never seen the original. I know that's terrible. I know.
We need to expand your education on Westerns, but the original is pretty damn good. But I really liked the remake. Really liked it, man.
Well, the remake is so good, and then I mean, in a lot of ways, then that the success of 310 to Yuma led to the director being able to direct the Wolverine sequel.
Yes.
And then he made Logan, which is basically a Western.
It's the best movie of all the Wolverine movies, because let's admit that the Wolverine movies have been turds.
Yeah. Well, the Wolverine is kind of a mess. There are pieces of it that I really love, but narratively, it's just like, wait, what's going on?
The last third of that movie, just absolute turd fest.
Yeah. There are pieces of it that I really love, but I think James Mangold like zeroed in on what he wanted, and when he was able to, you know, sort of create something out of whole cloth and, you know, say something with it, then he got something really great out of it, which was this great rumination on mortality and death and how we face that, and literally calling out the movie Shane in it. And,
that's true. Yeah.
You know, in a couple of places. So, you know, he's telling you like, this is a Western, this is what's going on. Anyway, we went pretty far afield from
coming our back. Clip.
But this is what we do on the terrible movies. We ended up talking about Knives Out on the Casino Royale episode. Now we'll talk about Logan in the our Man Flint episode. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, there was an explosion of spy movies. This one actually, and both of these actually did quite well in the box office, and we'll get there. But yeah, looking back on them, they're not great. You mentioned this felt like an American response to James Bond, and it just didn't hit. What makes this American and Bond British, and why doesn't it work? Because I was sort of picking up on that as well. But yeah,
even though he's helping out, the name of the organization's
Zowie.
Stupid Zowie. what the hell does it stand for? Zone organization of world intelligence and espionage.
There you go.
So I mean, that's just ridiculous. Even though he's working for Zowie, he's recruited by an American general. And it's very American. It takes place in the United States, the majority of it. It's not overtly American, at least not the first movie, but he does say some overtly American things. Like in the first movie, when he's caught by an eagle, he asks, "Why did that eagle attack me?" And then they're like, "Ha ha ha, it's trained to attack Americans. Like we have a smell to us or something." Anyway, so, and then he says, "An anti-American eagle. How diabolical." That whole phrase, that's the one phrase I've remembered forever because it's so stupid. And so, like, that's very rah-rah-rah USA kind of stuff. Granted, that happens in the last part of the film, but it just had this overtly pro-American feel. And there's a lot of stuff that he says in the movie that is like, oh, yeah, those are Americans. Like, the general says, "Hey, the world's in danger." I'm like, well, it's doing well without me. Why should I jump in? Which was pretty much our response to both world wars.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah. there's some overtly American themes happening there.
Yeah. And, I don't know, the very last scene of the second movie where he, like, seduces the female cosmonauts. Yeah, it's like, oh, I don't know. It's like, yeah, everything can get solved by Derek Flint and his machismo. So,
yeah.
Not great. You mentioned the American general. That is the angriest man of the 12 Angry Men, Lee J. Cobb.
Lee J. Cobb.
Famous character actor. What is he doing in this movie? I mean, what is James Coburn doing in this movie? I mean, I feel...
James Coburn was youngish,
mm-hmm.
I guess. Yeah. He's still... Well, he had hit a bit. Well, Magnificent Seven had already happened before this. He wasn't in Dirty Dozen, was he?
No, you're thinking The Great Escape.
The Great Escape. So he hadn't come out there yet, right? They hadn't come out yet? Am I mixing my ears?
Now I'm getting them mixed up. I think those both came out previous to this, but
okay.
Here, let me look at that.
Because I'd be surprised if he had already been cemented as a big star and he turned to this.
Yeah, well, I mean, but his bread and butter was being on Gunsmoke, like that was, you know, which or no, I'm sorry, Bonanza. Not Gunsmoke.
Right, I'm confusing him with what's his face. That was on Gunsmoke. What the hell was on Gunsmoke? No, it wasn't Landon. Landon was also in Bonanza, right?
I have never seen either of those shows. So
shoot, I don't know if I'm confusing with Landon or Bronson. One of those two was also either in Bonanza or Gunsmoke. I'm pretty sure we're going to be corrected by JB or somebody.
Sure. Bring it on.
If they're
looking. No, The Great Escape was 1963. So, and Bonanza was wrapping up its final season in 66. And
so he needed a job.
And so he needed a job. And here's, you know, spy movies are hot. So, 1966, Our Man Flint. And then the next year, they rush out a sequel in Like Flint in 67. So, and then in 1976, there is a made-for-TV movie that does not star Coburn and Cobb. Our Man Flint, dead on target. It was made for TV, and nobody saw it, nobody remembers it. So.
I had no idea there was a third movie, but... If it doesn't have Coburn, why the hell?
I mean,
why even do a sequel to this turd? But I mean, it should at least have Coburn,
right? Well, I mean, the reason to make the sequel is it made money. I mean, I feel like I should maybe, you know, we normally do the box office at the end here, but. I think this is important just to, like, create some context. Our Man Flint came out on January 16th of 1965, and made $16 million. It was the 11th highest grossing movie of that year. You know, $16 million doesn't sound huge, but the 11th highest grossing movie of the year. So that's a pretty big deal. And you know, it's coming out right in sort of the sweet spot of Bond. In 64, From Russia with Love came out in April. Goldfinger came out in December. This comes out in January. So this is like peak Bond, right after Goldfinger. You know, this would technically be in theaters the same time as Goldfinger, and you know, makes quite a bit of money. Thunderball comes out the end of that year, December of 1965, and you know, blows all of that away. And then in 67, In Like Flint comes out, and is in January of 67. So again, only about a month after, well, in this case, less than a month after Thunderball, and makes $11 million. So
it's kind of ballsy.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's kind of like, do you remember when you used to go into the video store and there'd be like the fake movies that were kind of like the big blockbuster movies? It's like,
right,
Transmogrifiers, and it looks exactly like Transformers.
I was gonna bring that up, that you know, if you go to the Alamo Draft House, they usually have like a you know, a whole bunch of shorts before the actual the feature movie,
right?
And I always laugh at the Indian versions of Spider-Man, or the Lithuanian versions of Captain America, right. And I crack up at that and think, who the hell watches these things? Like, who in that country is going? Well, we kind of had the same thing with In Like Flint. Like, we didn't have James Bond, but we had James Bond-ish. And people actually went. And you know what? Rotten Tomatoes has this movie, the first movie, at 79% approval. So
yeah,
people like it, and I don't know why.
Well, and again, to put that in context, I mean, $16 million is about what Dr. No made.
Really?
And wow, inflation adjusted, that's $144 million. So again, that's like what Detective Pikachu did last year. So it's Jesus, like, not an unsubstantial amount of money. $11 million for In Like Flint, that's like $83 million or so. Like, that's still a box office success, but it's not like a big movie. So, I mean, these were popular, and I think it's, you know, maybe people who went to the theater and they couldn't see Goldfinger, couldn't see Thunderball, and they're like, oh well, let's go to the cheap American knockoff and go to that instead. Or just people were stupid.
Yeah. I wonder how many people were like Trumpers, are like, yeah, this is American made. You know, we got to support.
This is American. We can't. This American. We don't like that British buy.
Let's go support our boy.
So,
because you know that was happening.
Probably. And here's my biggest problem with these movies is, I'm going to be brave and say this because no one else is willing to. Derek Flint is a Mary Sue.
Huh.
He
right.
is
Explain.
Preternaturally good at everything.
Oh, yeah.
There is nothing that he can't do. He literally knows everything. He like does one tiny little karate chop and people are dead. He is... There's literally nothing that he can't do. In the second movie, he's talking to dolphins. He's so smart. He's like, you know, he makes a joke that like, oh, I'm still on Moscow time. Well, what were you doing in Moscow? I was at the ballet. What were you doing at the ballet in Moscow? Oh, I was teaching it. And it's like, come on. It's like, that's not an interesting character when you are so good at everything. Oh, and before I forget, since we're talking about the Moscow ballet, did you notice who the Moscow yes. ballerina is in the second yes. movie?
Lily Munster.
No. It's Batgirl. Or wait, no. Was she Lily Munster too?
Yeah, Yvonne Craig, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she Yvonne.
Oh my gosh,
dude! I'm gonna look it up right now.
I've never made that connection before, and my worlds are colliding.
Hold on.
Oh, my brain is exploding, Mark.
See, but yes, Yvonne Craig.
Yvonne Craig, yeah.
Well, she was Batgirl.
Who? I seriously had the hots for when I was a kid.
Am I confusing her with somebody else?
No, I don't think so. Here, let me look this up on IMDb, because I think you could be right. I don't know.
I could be wrong. Probably am wrong. Because you can hardly tell who Yvonne Craig is with all that makeup. Who Lily Munster is with all that makeup. But I probably have it wrong. No, I do have it wrong. I always thought Yvonne Craig was Lily Munster.
Okay, well, we can take that part out. Let's just go ahead and say...
Well, I'm good being wrong. But
oh, okay. Are you sure?
I'm real good being wrong. I just always thought Yvonne Craig was Lily Munster. Now, who the hell is Lily Munster?
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I don't know. Anyway, so Yvonne Craig, not Lily Munster. However, still Batgirl, still Andy's boyhood crush. But you know, in this movie for literally like one or two lines. So
Yvonne DiCarlo. Sorry, my bad. I have my Yvonne's mixed up.
How dare you?
I know, I'm sorry. But I recognized who that person was.
Yeah. I think though, like as I made that connection though, and I'm like, oh, she was in Batman, and I started, I'm like, oh,
yes,
okay.
Yes, I know what you're gonna say.
Yeah, this is the Batman 66 version of James Bond. It's super campy. It's kind of dumb.
Yep.
But there's something about Batman 66 that's incredibly charming, and I don't get that charm here.
Well, Batman, and you know, when I was reviewing these movies, and I'm like, oh shit, you know, this is what it is. He's Batman without the mask. He knows everything. He's going to get out of everything. He's got an answer for everything. This is Batman. The big difference is that Batman 66 plays it cartoonish, knowing that they're playing it cartoonish. It's all in fun. It's all just one big old cartoon. This movie was supposed to be a serious response to James Bond because they invoke him early on. But they just don't understand that they got trapped in the cartoon. They couldn't break themselves from that little bubble they made for themselves. Had they done that and gone a more serious route, this thing might have been successful. We might still be having Flint movies right now, but we don't, because they didn't understand. They weren't in on the joke. And I think they realized it way too late.
Right. Well, and again, I said this about Casino Royale, but spoof movies are supposed to be funny.
Right.
I did not laugh at this movie.
Well, I don't think they approached it as a spoof. Times. That's the thing. I don't think they intended to make a spoof movie.
Yeah, I guess that's a question, is like when, but it's definitely intentionally campy. It's
yes.
Like they're definitely going for that rather than the serious, more, I mean, James Bond isn't really hard boiled, but it's got a, it's slick and it's serious and there are stakes. And this, it's like
the. Well, let's talk about that, because the stakes in the first movie are actually credible, and it's reminiscent of a previous Bond movie that we saw. And right. It's basically, we want to take nuclear weapons away from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's a noble cause. You know, maybe Derek Clinton's on the wrong side on this one, because you know, this is an actual group that wants to get rid of, you know, that stuff from the world. So there was like a credible threat that, you know, this thing could have gotten somewhere, but they got hung up on American superiority. We can make better gadgets. We're smarter. We don't have to do things. We don't have to put as much effort into things, because Derek Clinton can take care of things within 48 hours, apparently. Because that's what he says, right? 48 hours in the first movie. Second movie, right. He'll take care of it in a week. So this is very much like an American thing. Like, oh, we got this. We can do this. It'll be easy. You remember George Bush? Mission accomplished. We'll get it done in a month. This is very much an American point of view. So I struggle with saying that this is a spoof film. Like, we see that now. But I think they intended to do this quasi-seriously, at least. And in their defense, James Bond gets campy AF with Roger Moore.
Yeah, well, it definitely, yeah, and we're going to start seeing that movie by movie as we get closer and closer to Moonraker and Octopussy.
Yeah, it's, those are ridiculous.
It's gonna get campy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think that it's also interesting that they're using like weather. Like basically they invented climate change to like we're going to inflict climate change on you. The Arctic is now 4 degrees warmer and icebergs are melting. And American oil companies are like, yeah, hold my beer. we'll take care of that. We can do that.
Right, we'll do it for real.
Yeah, we'll do it for real. So, that was fun. And speaking of doing it for noble reasons, I also think in the second film, there's this weird subterfuge of like, there's this group of women who say that they want to take down the patriarchal order and replace it with a matriarchy. But then it turns out that they're actually being run by, like, their puppet strings are being held by men. Yeah. And they're not going to do that. And they, like, round up all the women and...
they help out the patriarchy.
Yeah, and then they... yeah, I don't get that.
They're like, down with the patriarchy, we hate men. But we'll also help you so you can maintain control by the end.
Right, right. I guess we'll help Derek Flint and Lee J. Cobb and the President of the United States, who are the only three men on our island. And wow, it's so lucky that we all have boats and we can just boat across the lagoon to the boys' camp across the lake and go and fight them.
Did you get that the ladies in the paddle boats were keeping up speed with the motorboats?
Yes.
Ain't possible, man. I've done this before. You get tired after 5 minutes. They crossed an entire ocean on a paddle boat. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And Derek Flint talking to his dolphin friend to get around.
Just so stupid. Yeah. I have no idea how he did that with a straight face. Like, that's just ridiculous.
I kept waiting for George C. Scott to show up and be like, yes, Pa loves Fa. That's a reference, God, folks, to a movie called Day of the Dolphin.
Day of the Dolphin.
Go watch that. Is that a spy movie? Not a spy movie.
Nah, I don't think so. I wouldn't classify it.
They were training the dolphins to like do spy work and like defense work, but yeah. Anyway, that movie, both of these movies, just, I don't know, abjectly ridiculous on a lot of different levels.
They are, but you know, a lot of the things that we're dealing with now that are hot button issues, we, especially younger folks, think like this is something that is just occurring now, that this is a millennial thing. It really isn't. Climate has always been a concern. We see this in this movie from 1965. Mm-hmm. Women's fight against the patriarchy and their fight for equality has been an issue since then. Like, these are not new issues, and we can at least see that in these two movies, that this has been a decades-long struggle, and we're still fighting these issues. So at least we can get that from these two movies that, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to do an incredibly terrible and problematic thing. Mark, let's talk about feminism and you and me adjudicate whether this is feminist or not. Because two dudes should definitely be the ones to have that conversation.
Yeah. Thanks, Brooke. We miss you, Brooke.
We'll solve this. We can determine whether this is feminist or not. Two dudes.
Yeah.
Figuring it out. Anyway, these movies are weird in that they do have this like feminist edge, but at the same time, they're completely not. Like, women are getting programmed in the first movie to be literally sex slaves.
Yeah.
And so Flint, yeah, James Coburn goes around and whispers in their ear and says, "You are not a pleasure unit." And they say, "I am not a pleasure unit." And it breaks their...
magically, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it breaks their mental conditioning, and their free will is restored. And then they all become a harem for Derek Flint instead. Yeah. Like, they're not pleasure units, but we love this dude who saved us. So, and everything with, like, is this, like, feminist or is this not feminist? Oh, and the other super disturbing thing, Derek Flint's secret code, he said, it created around the numbers 40, 23, 38.
It's based on... we know what it's based on.
We know what it's based on, and it's a running gag. Well, okay, 40, 23, 38.
Like, damn, who is this person?
That is impossible. Like, who looks like that? Nobody. That's like beyond Barbie doll.
Yeah.
And
like I said before, this is a 13-year-old's wet dream, because when I was younger and we talked about, you know, girls' figures and all that, we always talked about numbers like that. You know, I'm saying something, I'm revealing something gross about my past. But yeah. I mean, product of my time and all that crap. But when I was a kid, we used to say that, like, ooh, 38, 20, whatever, 36. Like, we didn't even know what the numbers meant. We were just repeating crap we heard. But, like, there were always ridiculous numbers. So, you know, it's very much on par with what this movie is and maybe who it's directed for or directed to.
Well, but, I mean, even, like, Brick House, like, 36, 24, 36. Only if she 5'3". Sir Mix-a-Lot, thank you. Anyway, yeah. but like, even that is like a little bit more normally proportioned, but like that, yeah, you're absolutely right that's, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous. And it is on the level of a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
In the end, Derek Flint is a lip service fembro, because he'll talk about, like, oh, you're not supposed to be a sex slave. However, I'd like to keep 5 of them in my house that pop up out of nowhere, that shave me and feed me and treat me like a king. And in the sequel, like, when he's asked, hey, what happened to all the other chicks? He's like, eh. I got married. I got a whole new set.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I don't think this guy should be the spokesman for feminism.
No.
Not at all. Oh, and then he has that comment when he's telling the ladies, like, how are you going to keep control without the men? And will you still have laps if you're wearing pants? And like, what the fuck are you talking about? What do you mean, will you still have laps? Like, this guy's just, he doesn't have a real feminist bone in his body.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, you know, oh, well, let's have it be, like, kind of feminist, but really feminism in service of being eye candy for men.
Yeah.
Is how it. Yeah. And, you know, and Derek Flint goes up and seduces the cosmonauts, and world peace is declared. So, you know, because that's how that works.
Yeah, because he's that good looking, I guess.
Well, I mean, James Coburn, not a bad looking guy.
Really? He's
a little skinny.
Way skinny. I mean, if I had to swing that way, that definitely wouldn't be the way I go.
He's just kind of a stick, and I don't know, but like those judo chops that he just and you're knocked out. Like, I mean, you've talked about Connery, like, taking people out with one punch. This is like, Connery looks like he could, you know, hold his own in a fight. You know, it's, and which isn't to say that, like, Coburn couldn't, like, but I mean, not with like some weird karate move. Or
yeah, no, I'm pretty sure I could have kicked James Coburn's ass.
Doing the full neck pinch on somebody.
He was way too skinny, dude. Plus, I outweigh him by I don't know how many tonnage. Like, I would have kicked his ass.
Yeah, but he's got reach.
Yeah, but it takes forever for that reach to get to me, man. He's got that's the slowest karate moves, man.
That's the age old argument: the speed versus reach.
Yeah.
Game of Death with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar,
or any boxing match Mike Tyson had.
Yeah.
The reach didn't really matter.
Yeah. So, anyway, what else is there to talk about in these movies? I mean, I guess his gadgets, his little watch thing that could like literally do anything.
Yeah, it wakes him up from a deep, from his, what, he would stop his heart for 3 hours or some crap.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Jesus. It just defies physics and like human anatomy.
Yeah, at least Bond's gadgets like made some sense. And this movie, like, it goes out of its way to like stick its thumb in James Bond's eye. They give him a Walter PPK and the briefcase with the knife in it, and he's like, oh, I won't need those toys. I've got my cigarette lighter that can do 78 things.
Yeah. Oh, and that comment when that one girl is reading the 0008 book about his life.
Yeah.
They make that flipping comment like, is anything in that real or some crap like that?
Yeah.
It's a lot of hate towards Bond.
And he meets 0008 and he's like, oh, this is bigger than Spectre. It's the galaxy. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, and Derek Flint does something that James Bond could never do. He can actually taste the differences between bouillabaisse all over France.
Yeah.
That's so ridiculous.
That's interesting. That's
such a Batman thing, though.
It's not only a Batman thing. At least, you know, with Batman, it was kind of funny. Because it's like, okay, yes, it's by the premise, by the bit. He's got the utility belt. He literally has everything in there. But then it's like got the hilarious name. It's like, it's the Bat Shark Repellent.
Right, right.
It's the, you know, so it's the running gag. But where you have the one thing that can just do anything, it's like, again, it's the whole Mary Sue aspect. There's never going to be any stakes because this guy is so good at everything. His gadgets can do everything. He's never going to fail. And even when he's been captured by the bad guys, it's like, oh, he just waits for a minute and then he's going to start judo chopping people and be able to make an escape.
Yeah, it's hilarious. And it's retarded. Well, it's stupid. The worst part, though, was at the end of the second movie where he uses his little sonic blaster thingy to thrust himself into the cosmonaut's little capsule. Like, oh my god, dude. Like, seriously? Like, that's just all sorts of horrible. I mean, maybe people didn't know
everything.
Yeah, maybe people didn't know better back then. I don't know, but it's just so stupid.
Yeah.
But by that point, I had already completely tuned out.
Right. Going back to the bouillabaisse for 2 seconds, one interesting thing, I do applaud them for getting this right, that bouillabaisse is really a regional dish of Marseille, and that there's definitely this feeling in French snobbery cooking that, like, unless you are making it in Marseille and you are French, you will never be able to make bouillabaisse. It just isn't bouillabaisse. It's like, so okay, cool. Like, I'm glad that they're able to bring that back down in there. The one other thing in that scene, the bad guy who he ends up fighting, did Did you happen to catch his name?
Hans Gruber.
Hans Gruber.
Yeah. We know him from?
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman.
And being thrown off the building in Die Hard. Hans Gruber. Hans Gruber. Who knew that? different villain, same name. I thought that was kind of fun. I was like, oh, Hans Gruber, what?
Yeah, I obviously didn't remember this from my first viewings of the movie, but when I saw them again yesterday, I was like, Hans Gruber, wait a minute, I know who this should be.
Yeah, it's like, you're not Alan Rickman. This isn't Die Hard. Now I want to watch a much better movie with the same guy in your the same villain. But I don't know. It's just not much else here to talk through.
Not really, man. It's just it's a whole bunch of bad. It's not as bad as Casino Royale. That Casino Royale is offensive on a whole load of fronts.
That's true. At least this has a narrative and it goes from A to B to C to D.
Right, right. They can see it through. There's no stupid, weird Scottish bagpipe dream sequence with Peter O'Toole. And you know, it at least it makes sense, like, overall as a story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not as offensive as Casino Royale, but it's not good.
Right.
Although 79% of people who've seen the movie disagree with both of us.
I wonder if that's either nostalgia or maybe it's like people who only watched this movie because it was in Austin Powers and because Mike Myers liked it, then maybe that means I feel like I should like it. But I don't know. Since we're seeing this in post Love Guru era Mike Myers, the bloom is off that rose, and I think we can all be just like, I see where you're going, Mikey. This is not what I'm.
No. I'm not well, here. Austin Powers worked because we knew that it was going to be a spoof. That, you know, it worked and it was funny, and made fun of all the right things. I mean, once again, I don't think this was meant as a spoof. I think they probably tried to make a serious movie, but they tried to one-up Bond, and it came out as a spoof.
Yeah, that's a good point. So
the big question is this better than Zardoz? Which we should revisit that question in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think we'll have to. I am. So, okay, good, important announcement. We can go ahead and say this now. The next several weeks, here's what we are going to do on the podcast. Next week, we are starting on into the Roger Moore era, and we'll start it off with Live and Let Die. Then we are going to go to Zardoz by kind of staying in chronological order. And then we'll go to the next few
Man with the next Golden few more
movies in order. And I don't think we will be taking a break again from Bond franchise movies until we get to the 1980s. It seems like most of the other films that are winning in the poll right now are mostly from the late 90s and 2000s, 2010s. So that's where we're going to go. We'll just go straight through the mess of the Roger Moore era. But that's what we've got.
Well, you call it mess and I call it like childhood nostalgia.
Yeah, okay.
This was the Bond I grew up with. You know, I didn't really go into Connery until after. And I was like, well, he's better. But okay, Roger Moore was my Bond for a long time.
I have to say, you and John Madsen are like expanding my mind and challenging me to be more open-minded to Roger Moore this time around. That
really,
like,
should.
Maybe there's something to being open to just like camp and silliness and gadgets, and it'll all be okay. And I know that on the other side of it, we get to talk about The Living Daylights. So.
I was about to say, our fondness for Roger Moore Bond is as confusing to you as your fondness towards Dalton is confusing to us.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say any kind words about License to Kill.
All right. And well, you shouldn't.
I have very specific reasons why I like Living Daylights.
Well, the song to begin with.
Song and the movie. And I understand why people may not like those. So anyway. But that's about it. I mean, unless you've got anything else you want to throw in on Derek Flint.
There are no more insights into Derek Flint, but we should probably put a poll to see what people think of the movie. Those who've seen it. I want to see if I'm on the wrong side. If people think this is actually an entertaining movie. How many of y'all listening actually like these movies? I'd be interested to know.
It's a good question. And worth noting, if you want an easy way to watch these, they are both available on YouTube. They're not the greatest quality, but you can watch them that way.
Or you can get a 1 week free trial on Cinemax, and they're both on Cinemax.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, then.
High quality.
There you go. High quality on Cinemax. Come for Derek Flint. Stay for the soft porn. Cinemax.
what you do with the rest of your time on Cinemax is between you and your TV.
Indeed. I mean, there is stuff. You've got to do something in all this social isolation, you know? Anyway. I think that about wraps her up. I want to say one more thing about Lee J. Cobb. I love Lee J. Cobb. I think he's so talented, and I just feel so bad for him being in here. 12 Angry Men is one of my like top 10 favorite films of all time, and he is so great in that as the angriest of the jurors and facing off against Henry Fonda. They're just great, and
I'll kill you.
Yeah, you work your heart out with these kids. Oh, he's so good. He's so good, and this is not good.
Yeah, he went from that to this.
Poor guy. But you know, guys got to eat, and I understand and respect that, and I hope that the money that he made from this movie bought,
a house,
a nice house in Malibu or something. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Well, Derek Flint, go to the Kiss Your Franchise Goodbye Facebook page and vote in our new poll of whether you like the Derek Flint movies or not. And go, and if you want us to review different movies outside of the Bond franchise, go ahead and vote them up, because we are still taking suggestions as to what those should be. We are doing Zardoz right after right after Live and Let Die, which is coming up next week. But until then, stay safe. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Yeah, always, man. It's fun. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll be back next time with even more people, and we promise we will talk about feminism with women next time.
Real promise, women.
Promise. Real women.
Bye, everybody.
Okay, bye. Big kiss.
a perfect day to throw back your head and kiss it all goodbye.
Thank you. That will be all.
God damn it! That's not all. Because if one of those things gets down here, then that will be all. And all this bullshit that you think is so important, you can just kiss all that goodbye.